Phone check. 1, 2, the microphone check. 1, 2, 1, 2, the microphone check. I got my headphones tuned between two different AM stations, and my briefcase is full of declassified information. Declassified, declassified, and I'm reading it under the lens of your radio. I'm dissecting it and bleeding it. I read the world for breakfast, and after lunch I write it. I let me get me down, and then I stand back up and fight it. I read the news today, oh boy, oh boy. I know linguistics, statistics, pundits, and mystics. I voted for Ralph Nader. I read Docs and Raider. I got 1,000 signatures and sent them to Darth Vader. I'm reading U.S. News and World Report, Time Life, and The Post. I know more than other DJs because I read the most. And when I squint to the west, I can see Afghanistan. I put my head between my knees and I can see Iran. I get documents online and then I analyze them. They know I'm out there waiting so they don't declassify them. I bug the White House and I bug the Pentagon. In the filling in my molar, I got my descrambler on. I got the truth. I got Paul Muth. We got better lines than Haydn Carruth. We put our 11 cents in, just like Marx and Lenin. Paul's like Carl McCartney, but I'm John Lennon. We'd love to turn you on. I say I want a revolution, and I want to stop it all. I finished all 3 volumes up of Marx's Capital. You know, everything that old boy wrote is up on my shelf, and every single bit I translated myself. I'm reading and I'm learning, and when the tide is turning, it'll warm my heart in part to see the dollar bills burning. They weren't built in a day, but all roads lead to Rome. I'll do fine just as the Romans with my main man, Rome. I'd like to tell you a story about a little man, if I can. A gnome whose name was Chomsky. I'm MCS of the Rook. I got a voice like milk. I'm the best dressed man you ever heard. Can you hear this tie? It's silk.
It's mid-morning on the last day of the week, and you're listening to News from Neptune. Carl Estabrook and Paul Muth discussing the news of the week and its coverage by the media. Archives of this show in free software formats are available at newsfromneptune.com. Thanks to the technical expertise of Dr. No, Jeff Nicholson-Owens.
And here we are on the, what is it, the 18th of February.
It's not the last day of the week in some people's calendars, of course. You know, well, some people start their week on other days. So.
I suppose you can do what you want, yeah. You don't even have to observe the 7-day week if you don't want to.
Question authority. But,
do what you wish.
Trying to wade through the news coverage. The lampooning of the press by the right wing, I enjoyed a little bit of the taste I got from Comedy Central's sort of lampooning the Cheney frenzy by the press by sort of mixing up the metaphors with the weapons of mass destruction. I was like, okay, you might get to the bottom of this story. I doubt it, but you certainly didn't get at the bottom of any other recent stories that Cheney was involved with. You think he drinks bourbon when he's in Texas and scotch when he's in Wyoming? I wonder about that. I understand the Secret Service thought there was a leak, but his hip flask was intact.
I like the...
I've been working on that for a while. It wasn't worth it, I'm sure.
I like the fact that Fox News, when they ran the interview with him, cut the part where he said, oh, yes, I had a beer at lunch. You know, they didn't broadcast that.
Whereas Miss Armstrong said, oh, we were serving Diet Pepsi, so I guess he must have smuggled in his own beer.
Well, there is the question of why Mr. Cheney took 14 hours to talk
sober
to
up.
The authorities about it. Yeah, and one of the suggestions was, yeah, a little too much blood alcohol, too much alcohol in his bloodstream, or the other way around, and that was...
I was watching some of the comedic response. I don't usually watch Letterman, but his top 10 list of reasons why it happened was, the top one was... the gun was loaded and so was I. Mm-hmm. Number 6 was part of our campaign to make Bush look like the smart one, which was a pretty clever line, too. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. I think there was another one that had to do with the lesbian daughter. Don't say that about my lesbian daughter. Letterman was bringing that up a lot, actually. Anyway...
I thought the Daily Show did a nicer job of juxtaposing the Cheney shooting with the killing of 500,000 people in the Middle East, pointing out
that's
that the justifications could be recycled.
What I tried to evoke that particular one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, they got better writers than us, I suppose, but it is hard to believe that he's going to use this to blame the media. But as I recounted when he was challenged about his or was talking about his trip to Iraq, when he was challenged by an officer, I mean, he only talks to officers when he's over there, who said that things don't look like they're getting better to me, sir. Mm-hmm. And Cheney said, well, you're reading the wrong papers. So he blames the media in every circumstance.
Well, this is popular this week. Rumsfeld was doing this again. He says our problem, the reason we're having troubles in Iraq, is that the media are against us, and we have to do something about the media because the media don't criticize the insurgency the way they criticize the United States. And that's simply wrong, says Rumsfeld.
And the press war is being lost, so he's
yeah, exactly.
He's going to have to open some new fronts in the press war. I think he was trying to not dump on the press as blatantly as Cheney was. Apparently, there's some friction between Rummy and Cheney, which John Nichols, the guy that has the book The Rise and the Rise of Richard B. Cheney, which was formerly titled Dick, the Man Who Is President, he's a writer for The Nation. He's got a good piece that says, okay, let's get on to some of the real stories in Cheney's Cheney's closet.
Well, I think there is an ongoing division that in the second Bush administration, as I've mentioned before, between the looters and the killers. The killers have had the whip hand all along, and the looters are deciding that they've made a hash. The killers have made a hash of it, and they've got to take over again. And go to work for the people that Bush is really responding to. That is his base, the wealthy. And there were two articles in the Wall Street Journal in the last week that I thought set out the problem, not explicitly, but the first article was about a week ago when there was a list of they pointed out that Larry Franklin, one of the major neocons, is parking cars in a mall right now. He was sentenced to 12 years in prison.
Yeah, well, he should be doing valet service at the prison at least.
He was sentenced to 12 years in prison for espionage, and until he goes off to jail, he has a family and so forth, and so he's taking what work he can. And they started with that, pointing out that the neocon group, of which Franklin was a central member working for Douglas Fife, have split. They've gone various other places, like Fife himself, and that the neocons' influence is ebbing in every place except in the Pentagon. And the peculiarities we've observed in Mr. Rumsfeld, I know it's hard to tell peculiarities because he's peculiar enough all the time, but his recent peculiarities have been even more peculiar, suggests that there's a faction fight going on inside the administration with the neocons losing. And that's what the front page piece of the Wall Street Journal strongly implied. And then less than a week later, there's another front page piece, even more prominently displayed on the Wall Street Journal, about how the Bush administration was reaching out to CEOs for diplomacy. And it regaled us with the usual stories in the current journalistic fashion. You tell little stories about things people are doing. And it had to do with the fact that the Secretary of State was busily recruiting corporate leaders around the country to do things for the administration. Now, the first story they had was a CEO that was willing to go off and do something about Pakistani relief after the earthquake. But the burden of the article, once again, you have to read between the lines, as you always do in the Wall Street Journal, the burden was once again a shift in authority in the Bush administration. The CEOs are back in charge, and the Pentagon leaders are much less in charge.
Regular listeners will note that I always think that the distinction kind of blurs because Cheney is a good representative of a killer and a looter. And I thought you were going to mention maybe they're going to send the guy from Coca-Cola to go down to Columbia to try to
that'd be get dangerous.
Them to, wouldn't get it? Them to kill union activists a little more discreetly or something. That might help. Help the image of America a little bit. The point I was trying to get to with John Nichols' article, John Nichols, was that apparently Rummy wanted to be picked for vice president. You know, Cheney was Rummy's understudy. That's how he got his way forward in the Ford administration. And when Cheney picked himself, apparently Rummy had some animosity from the get-go, and he got second prize.
He may still have a chance. The job may be opening up.
Noonan in the Wall Street Journal's inside the, not on the front page, apparently wrote a piece saying that it would be very convenient for Cheney to somehow bow out or be finessed out so that Bush could pick somebody to be his anointed candidate to succeed him. Maybe he could pick his father again. Are you allowed to run again if you're not running consecutively or something?
The question's been raised. That's right. Well, no, I mean, you know, he doesn't serve two terms, so he's not debarred. I mean, George Bush Sr. would not be debarred from the presidency. He only served one term.
Oh, that would make for great fun with the 41-43 conversations that...
That is Chester Alan Arthur or whoever it was who fouled it up the last time, yeah, by running out of, I mean, serving, you know, separated terms.
Hmm. Anyway, kind of an angular report. I was just noting as before we came in that as well as being on the 50,000-acre ranch of the daughter of the woman who picked Cheney for Halliburton, the daughter of the executive that started Brown and Root, Mr. Brown, was also there. So this was crony fest.
The story that was kicking around on the net, you know, that I didn't see mentioned in any of the responsible places, so obviously we should mention it here, is that part of the reason for the long delay before notifying the press and the authorities and so forth was that one of the members of the party was the woman who was ambassador to Switzerland, and it was suggested was a great and good friend of Mr. Cheney, and that Mrs. Cheney, who was not a member of the party, was not very happy with this with this juxtaposition, and that she, the Swiss ambassadress, she had to be. Her presence had to be finessed before the press or the authorities should be...
Pretty handy. I think it was right in 2004, the legacy of Cheney's dealings in Nigeria with some kind of bribes paid to get natural gas out of Nigeria that this woman's longstanding ambassador to helped unfreeze the funds. In Switzerland, the Halliburton funds were actually frozen because of this... process the trial going on.
Yeah,
which we still. Cheney, another thing that's down the memory hole.
Cheney was essentially under indictment for that in France, wasn't he? I mean, there was a magistrate in France. Well, with their system, wanted him to testify on that.
The witness list. That's right. I don't know. I think he might have been able to get out of it because he was always in an undisclosed location whenever they were trying to serve him his papers or something.
Well, remember Lynn Cheney, the vice president's wife, wrote a novel once about a vice president who has a heart attack while in flagrante with his mistress, and to take his place, his wife is tapped to become the new vice president. And she wrote this, 10 years ago or something.
Cheney. Well, that would be an idea. So Dick will bow out and Lynn will take over.
Well, and Lynn Cheney, of course, has been, you know, one of the more virulent neocons all along. I mean, condemning one time when she started one organization I like particularly. It was supposed to be an organization of concerned alumni where she would get people from... alumni or trustees?
Trustees
of various universities around the country, to try to say, well, look, there are people in these American universities that really shouldn't be there because they're not loyal enough to America, and they had a list. I noticed that David Horowitz just published a list of 100 academics we could do without it. Yeah,
it's a book on 100 people or something.
That's right, of people, and it's a very strange list. I mean, people have...
NPR had some coverage of it. Which
the ones that are included and the ones that are omitted are just as funny. But in any case, Lynn Cheney had done this under the aegis of a neocon group some time ago. So, I mean, she is a firmer ideologue, perhaps, than he is. I mean, back to the distinction, you know, she's a killer and he's a looter, perhaps. But I don't know. In any case...
That was released right at the beginning of the Gulf War, and anybody that was speaking against it, of course, Chomsky was on it, Jensen was on it. I wonder, did anybody around here make it? Did McChesney get on Horowitz's list?
McChesney is on Horowitz's list, I think, yes.
And, congratulations.
But, as I say, it's a peculiar list, and the sort of madness of that segment of the right, you know, is not much of a surprise.
Amazing stuff going on in the press war. did you hear about the scandal about Haiti? How NPR is using a stringer from Voice of America to do their Haitian coverage?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You did hear about that?
Yep.
A woman named.
We talked about that a while ago, actually.
No, this was a different story. There was a woman on retainer from the National Endowment for Democracy. Mm-hmm. who was reporting from Haiti. She wasn't necessarily reporting for NPR, but no, this is another story, another woman who's down in Haiti who's working for VOA, but she's also acting as the NPR stringer without any acknowledgement. Her name is Amelia Shaw, and I did hear a repeat on Flashpoints out of Berkeley, a great show, flashpoints.net, he actually replayed a conversation between the host Inskeep and this Amelia Shaw, who was NPR/VOA. We make that in comparison a lot because, you know, the chief executive of NPR, I forget his name at this point, is ex-VOA. So I think that's part of where the press far is happening. The stuff that Inskeep said was as bad. I mean, what they're doing now is they were trying, the election was almost stolen from Preval, but now they're tainting it by saying it's a deal that was cut, when it's really clear that there were so many, you know, it was sort of Ohio writ large, where they had, they didn't even have any voting booths in the major population centers that were Preval supporters, and all of these structural impediments to a fair election were going ahead, and Preval prevails anyway. And now that, because of the way that it was adjudicated and a deal was cut on it, it's tainted, and you'll hear about this contested election. And Inskeep was like evoking mob rule, that it was the reason why the election was decided the way it was, is because he could get more people out in the street and influence the election. It's a pretty amazing. You can go to, like I mentioned, flashpoints.net, IJDH.org, I forget actually what that stands for, Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, has some good information about that as well. But it was just scandalous. And then to have, you know, these two journalists, one on NED, which is funding the IRI, the International Republican Institute, which was really the vehicle for the coup that that drove Aristide out. And I think the State Department actually said that Preval better not think of doing anything uppity like letting Aristide return. Ah, voila.
Well, the one thing about it, of course, is that it was indeed a deal. I mean, what's happened here, that the election in Haiti is more like the coup in Venezuela in 2002, I think. I mean, obviously the election was fixed. The election was a mess from beginning to end, and they thought to make sure that they could control the ballot. But in a certain replay of the 1990 election, where against the State Department's wishes, the people of Haiti brought Aristide to the presidency, they did manage here to produce enough, as a friend of mine put it, heat in the street, to make sure that the popular will could not be overcome by the government that the U.S. had put into place in Haiti. So indeed, there was a deal, because, you know, I mean, you know, there's no, there was clearly no fair election in the sense of a real poll of the Haitian people. But nevertheless, they overcame it, as I said, sort of like the coup in Venezuela. Well, and René Préval, you know, is probably the best that could do. Now, the interesting thing is, Préval has said
that. Actually, that's my misgivings.
Préval had said that he would bring Aristide, that, you know, Aristide would be welcome to return. And that'll be very interesting to see whether he's able to bring that off.
The thing that I remember, Préval was the prime minister after, you know, the interpretation of the restoration of Aristide didn't allow him to run again, because even though he hadn't fulfilled his full term, because he was ousted. You know, there were some people arguing at the time that he should have been able to run again, because he wasn't he wasn't allowed to run his full writ. But
such legal niceties were not, you know, not observed.
I don't know whether Préval, you know, he actually did cooperate with a lot of privatization and unfair, you know, distribution of state resources, in my opinion.
Well, as did Aristide.
Yeah,
I mean, that was the deal.
There was a lot of pressure.
That was what the Clinton administration insisted on Aristide, to allow him to come back at all.
Right.
So it's it's true.
So, you know, and they'll probably use the holding back of development aid, you know, which it ought to be restitution and reparations for the decades and almost century of devastation of Haiti that's been perpetrated both by France and the U.S., but they'll work their will through the usual functioning, send down some hitmen, some economic hitmen. I've been trying to read that, but I got diverted back to this book about Cheney since it seemed apropos. But
yeah, in a way, I mean, I suppose the administration should be glad that it has the Cheney incident to talk about this week, because the other news, there were many more important stories than Cheney's accident, and the stories reflected very badly indeed on the administration, most notably the publication of some more of the Abu Ghraib pictures. The administration has been moving heaven and earth to try to make sure that no more of the materials from Abu Ghraib came forth, and now a few of them have, through an Australian news place and through Slate, the online
Salon.
The point is that all of these groups have them, and all of these news groups have them, and they're all withholding them. So it's it has to be an Australian journalist who finally publishes the stuff in Australia, and an online service here that does. Now that's like the New York Times retaining its story about the spying, the NSA spying for a year. I mean, this is malfeasance on the part of the news of the media, but what they're exposing is far more horrible. That is the torture in American prisons. The United States, the UN Commission on Human Rights, this week also said that what the U.S. is doing in Guantanamo is torture, and that the U.S. Should either try or release the prisoners there. Now, that would seem elementary under the American Constitution, but we have to be reminded by the United Nations Commission on Human Rights, that this is a standard principle of international law. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. response to this was wonderful, Paul. The U.S. responds to the United Nations Commission by saying the report is based on hearsay. Well, why is their report based on hearsay?
Allegations that have been made by lawyers representing some of the detainees from McClellan. Yeah.
The point is that it's based on hearsay because the United States refused the UN Commission permission to talk to the people in Guantanamo. So
amazing. They actually called for it to be closed, and I repeat that I think we ought to get off that island. Our lease ran out. There's no reason for it's a very colonial remnant, and the UN was supposed to be doing decolonization work throughout the world, and it ought to make a statement on that as well, but don't hold your breath. I think we ought to get out of Puerto Rico. Apparently there's a massive widespread crackdown in Puerto Rico that you have to listen to alternative media to find out anything about, and I haven't done the investigation. I'm curious how some people I know from University of Puerto Rico fared in this crackdown. Apparently it was simultaneous raids, I don't know, many multiple sites of anti-colonial activity, and again under the pretext that it was a part of the war on terror. Anything they declare as the war on terror is the war on terror.
And this is important. I mean, remember that the FBI had killed a longtime independence leader in Abu Ghraib in Puerto Rico. Independence in Abu Ghraib too, but a longtime independence leader in Puerto Rico some months ago. They surrounded his house and shot him. And this has caused a tremendous outcry on the island, which has produced some of the difficulties that the government was trying to deal with by these recent raids, this is serious stuff, and I think you're right that the war on terror rhetoric, we're fighting terrorism as an excuse, works every place. Rumsfeld this week talked again about a vast expansion of the special operations capability of the military, and it's a terrible thing, Paul. I mean, this article is worth reading. This is in this morning's Wall Street Journal, as a matter of fact. The special operations are capable. Special operations forces are capable of doing things that other forces aren't, Mr. Rumsfeld says. Now, what he wants to do here, basically, is run private wars. He wants to be able to send these military groups in, these basically death squads, into any country that where they can claim terrorism, just as you say. That they say, yes, we're going after terrorists, and therefore all the legal niceties can be set aside. I mean, there's a great tradition of this. Rumsfeld isn't doing it entirely on his own hook. I mean, the great change came, some what, 45 years ago, with the Kennedy administration establishing the Green Berets, which was a special operation group, and their job was basically to set up death squads. They were primarily concerned about Latin America and then, of course, Vietnam. So this tradition, it has a long tradition in the American government. We have another example here, the way in which the current administration is imitating the Reagan administration of the early 80s, which was imitating the Kennedy administration of the early 60s. There are a number of parallels there. On this area of special operations, it's particularly notable.
What is amazing is that there's death squads. I guess it's a more Casablanca effect. It's shocking that there are death squads, and the U.S. is portraying itself as having some army people that are stopping, the Bader Brigade from doing a death squad hit.
Yeah, that's interesting.
When only like 4 months ago,
right,
the El Salvador option was offered as a way to go ahead. It's totally a memory hole. I mean, this was offered as a way of fighting the insurgency.
This is what the Pentagon was saying publicly. That was the most remarkable thing.
And then there's like, where's the coverage that has any memory of that being part of the discussion? I mean, it is absolutely astonishing.
This is important, I think, this week. The U.S. publicized how the American military stopped a Shiite group that was in police uniforms. It was apparently a Shiite death squad with Sunnis that they said they were going to take to execute. Now, this is very interesting. I mean, as usual with these stories, the first question is how does the story get out, and whose purposes are served by getting the story out? And only then do you ask about the truth value of the story itself. Well, here the American military is doing exactly what Alex Coburn suggested some months ago. When he said, how long is it going to be before we hear about the U.S. shifting money, support, guns, and logistical concerns to the Sunnis over against the Shiite government that we have malgré lui set up in Iraq? I mean, the U.S. is in the embarrassing position of having established a government which is closer to Iran than any other government in the world, and we've done this as the result of the remarkably arrogant and incompetent occupation of Iraq. And so now suddenly the U.S. is shifting back in the direction of Sunnis and saying, my God, these guys, these Shiites are running death squads. We taught them how to do it.
And if they start aiding the Sunnis, that's tantamount to arming a civil war, what will happen.
The U.S. has been encouraging all along. I mean, divide and conquer has always been part of the imperial rule. Yes, exactly.
Al-Sadr announced that he indeed would do, I think he's repeating something he said earlier, if there was any attack on Iran, that they would take Iran's side, and this is a guy that controls the largest single block of voters in the parliament. I'm not sure if that's actually right.
He's got a good chunk of seats, though.
A chunk that he's forged out of. He is a Arab extracted Shia. A lot of the Shia in Iraq are actually, their lineage goes back to Persian, if you will. The categories get pretty suffuse, but diffuse, I guess, is the word I wanted there.
Iran says this week, and felt emboldened him enough because of the circumstances we described, to demand that the British get out of Basra. Now, remember, the few British troops that are in Iraq are in the area around the city of Basra, which is basically 20 miles from the Iranian border. I mean, it's, but Iran says it wants the Brits out. Iran has charged for a while now that the Brits were carrying on special operation things in southern Iran, particularly in the areas which are mixed in terms of the ethnic identity and so forth, including bombings. The Brits say, no, we haven't been doing it, but the Iranians have said they have been for a while. And we do know that there's been reports, even in the American press, notably Seymour Hersh's New Yorker piece last year, talking about the ways in which Americans and Israelis were running special operations things in Iran. And that, by special operations things, they mean sabotage and killings. It's not at all out of the question that the Iranians are quite right about what the Brits are doing.
Some of it, they're using this Iranian opposition group that is fairly explicitly supposedly Marxist-Leninist. I forget the acronym for that, but Hirsch mentioned it in the article as well. So they actually have some outside operators who they used to have on their terrorist list not so many months ago. And they may still be on their list, but apparently they're liaising with them and helping helping them out in the... strange bedfellows, as the expression goes.
Yeah, strange bedfellows indeed. One of the oddest is the group called, I think, Mujahideen al-Khalq. This is a group that has a group of Iranians that have a pedigree of opposition to the Iranian government going back to the revolution in 1979, but they've morphed in a peculiar way. They have a large group of them are in France, and the thing has taken on a sort of cult-like aspect. The leaders are a man and his wife, and the suggestion is the wife is the more important leader, but they actually have armed fighters on the ground in Iraq and apparently in Iran, and the U.S. government has been going through a very peculiar dance with these people as to whether they support them or not, because their ideology is so strange and their internal structure is so disturbing. A lot of strange bedfellows here.
This is a different group, though. They're the ones. It's hard to keep track of all this, but I think they're the ones that want to restore a Shah.
No, they're specifically they're not pro Shah, but they have been in opposition. I mean, they started off as an explicitly secular group in opposition to the religious revolution in 1979.
Here's a program noting for Pacifica. Go to pacifica.org for the specifics. There's going to be a town meeting in Houston on the evictions of the Katrina victims, is one way to call them, I guess.
This is important
this evening, and I don't know how it'll be run or what kind of testimony there will be, but it'll be on the web.
There is an interesting poll this week showing Americans far more upset by the Katrina business than by some of the other issues, some of the issues that the administration, for example, wished Americans were talking about, but concerned with screw-ups around Katrina by this administration are as high as concerns about the screw-ups about Iraq and about the economy. Yeah. So, I mean, these things are coming together, and with numbers substantially more than half of the American populace saying something is going quite wrong here.
Yeah, Chertoff and Brown are duking it out, and it's pretty much pox on both of their houses, but Brown is the fall guy, and Chertoff, who could have declared the area as an emergency on his own dime, considering how much power has been accumulated in this so-called Homeland Security outfit. Since I'm shopping for health care these days in the health centers down in Barnes, St. Louis, I thought I would make a little pitch that I don't think that's the correct model for saving money with health care. It's not like shopping for cantaloupes. You don't shop for health care, and it's a ridiculous idea. It's really a very thinly veiled way of giving more tax relief, in quotes, to the wealthiest. The healthiest and wealthiest people are allowed to put these money in these tax-free accounts and then bail out on the insurance system by getting high deductible, lower cost insurance policies. And it's just outrageous the way that this is offered. This is the only thing offered as a solution, should be lampooned and booted out of the discourse as much as Bush's attempt to, quote, solve the Social Security problem was. But I'm afraid it isn't. I think there is too much Democratic sympathy big D Democratic sympathy for this kind of quote-unquote solution.
Well, that goes back to the Clinton proposals in 92 and 93. And
they didn't
they
even offer anything quite that harebrained.
But, well, I would say, I think the Rube Goldberg device they did offer was just as harebrained in its way. What I think is most shocking about the current situation is the administration is selling on the grounds that it gives people more control, more choice in their health care. Well, what it gives people is more choice to pay out of their own pocket for their health care rather than setting up what all the other industrialized societies have, a system in which you're treated on the basis of how sick you are, not on how well off you are.
I clipped again the the quote from the Jylands Poston editor's reply to the guy that wanted to put the satirical cartoons depicting Christ. I've talked to people and they don't think that it's related somehow, but his quote is, I don't think the readers of Jylands Poston would be pleased with the drawings. I think they would cause an outrage. That's why I won't use them. That was in April of 2003 when the same editorial journalist who published this had this contest for the Muhammad caricatures said about satirical cartoons depicting Jesus Christ. I guess he was asked about it later, and he said, "Well, I just told him that, but they just weren't very good cartoons." You know, it's like, "Yeah, give me a break." So,
yeah, you suggest a little hypocrisy here?
More than a little. It stinks to high heaven, and people here, you know, we even have this little brouhaha locally at the institution down the block about. And they're not even trying to discuss the issue of the cartoons themselves. They just want to limit it to, did you follow the procedure?
Well, the issue of the cartoons themselves is, in fact, a far less important issue than the fact that the administration has shifted to a justification for its global war on terrorism that is explicitly anti-Muslim. We heard in the State of the Union address the president talk about radical Islam, and Rumsfeld, who, as I say, I think is fighting off enemies both within the administration and outside, say now that the reason for the global war on terrorism is that, and the reason that he wants to be able to send troops on his own hook into other countries and kill people, is special operations, you know, is the need to fight the global extremist Islamic empire. Now, Rumsfeld has never been a phrase maker, but nevertheless, that's the phrase he's using. And I think what we see here, Paul, is actual a shift in the administration's rhetoric. I mean, these cartoons come along at a wonderful time for them because they can say, look at all those mad Muslims out there burning embassies. That's the sort of people that we're fighting, because if we let things go, if we don't kill people in countries around the world, we will be threatened with the global extremist, global extremist Islamic empire. So it works wonderfully for the administration right now.
Yeah, a point I wanted to make, and I believe it's called The Devil's Game. Amy Goodman has had this fellow on, and where he's talking about how the U.S. helped fuel Islamic fundamentalism.
Well, of course.
And the point that Hamas was funded by the Israelis as a counterbalance to the secular PLO at the time.
Exactly.
It should not be,
it's not an isolated incident.
It's not an isolated incident. You know, we have Al-Qaeda partially because we promoted jihadism.
We got the most fanatic Islamic fighters we could find and sent them into Afghanistan before the Russians invaded in order to annoy the Russians.
Yeah. But we don't get any discussion of that.
It was done in a democratic administration, which is one of the reasons. But still in all, it's you're absolutely right. I mean, this is an overarching policy. I mean, you should realize this goes back to the post-war period, back to the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations, when the real problem was secular Arab nationalism centered then in Egypt and headed by the president of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser. And the U.S., in its great fear of Arab nationalism, secular Arab nationalism here, looked for a counterweight to it. And as the counterweight, they thought, was religious nationalism. We mentioned the fact that as far away as Iran, when the U.S. put the Shah back on the throne in Iran in 1953, the Islamicists were in favor of it. They were against the secular government of Mohammad Mossadegh, which the U.S. overthrew.
They were manipulated,
so
too.
This was the U.S. policy to destroy secular nationalism in the Arab world, and indeed in the Islamic world as a whole, meant that the sort of residuary legacy were these Islamicist groups, the religious radicals, which eventually moved to the position of opposing what the U.S. is doing, because what the U.S. was doing was clearly not in the interests of the majority of Islamic people.
Even in the Iranian revolution that brought eventually the mullahs to power and Khomeini, Bonnie Sandra is a name that dropped out of the mat. There was a huge response to the Shah. The Savak torture was one of the main things that united people across religious boundaries. But the U.S. cooperated, actually, you know, despite the fact that the Iran was the great Satan. The U.S. apparently, in a very nefarious way, cooperated in decimating the secular left inside the Iranian revolution. And
because we were more worried about a secular left than we were about what seemed to be a religious-led occupation, even though the religious-led revolution, even though that revolution was holding American diplomats after the...
Well, the point that we characterize it as from religious-led is, I think, is part of the memory hole of history. There were a lot of strands in the revolt against the Shah.
Yep.
And the secular one has been sort of deleted from history, and the U.S. actually had a role in helping the deletion.
That's because the U.S. wants to construct these mad Islamicists as the enemy. It's the global extremist Islamic empire that we have to fight. Now, I mean, I think this is, I think there's been a recent shift in administration rhetoric on this point. We've heard, particularly since Hamas won the election for the Palestinian Authority, we've heard less and less about the Bush goal of establishing democracy in the Middle East, because this democracy thing isn't working out quite the way they wanted it to. Well, and that, remember, was the substitute for the weapons of mass destruction, which meant we had immediately to go to Iraq and kill a lot of people. So, I mean, the house of cards that is the U.S. propaganda system, you know, has just fallen once again and is quickly being rebuilt in an anti-Muslim fashion.
Yeah. Well, it was such a farce to begin with, because the U.S. was so anti-democratic through the years, and well, you know, propaganda was that the U.S. was going to leave that realpolitik and actually back democracy, right?
Yeah. Our mentor, Noam Chomsky, in whose honor this program is named, published a book at the beginning of the 90s called Deterring Democracy. Right. That's it. Deterring Democracy.
Last good book they printed.
And it described in detail how the U.S. Presented itself up to that point as the champion of democracy, spreading democracy around the world. But that was true only if you understood democracy to mean doing what American business interests have in mind.
Let's see. There's so much, so little time left here.
How about this? This is something I'd be interested in seeing.
I think
that we might disagree about. I don't know. Perhaps I'm wrong.
No.
This is from this morning's New York Times on the the most prominent place. The headline is Bush sees need to expand role of NATO in Sudan. New commitment by U.S. West is urged to double peacekeeping troops in Darfur region. Now, I suggest that what we're hearing from the administration right now, and one of the things that warns me about this, is that there's unity on this point between the administration and the Democratic leadership, as we say laughingly, in the Congress. The unity is that something must be done about Darfur. Well, what I hear here, Paul, is something must be done about Kosovo from 7-8 years ago. And there certainly have been terrible things that have occurred in Western Sudan
and are occurring.
But in the American presentations, it's. I mean, always in America, if you want to talk about political problems, you have to cast it in terms of race. You know, I mean, because other political realities are too dangerous for us to talk about. There has indeed been ethnic killing going on in Western Sudan. But in the U.S., it's presented as those nasty Arabs killing those nice black people. Arabs are a good hate object for the United States and have been for a while, because it travels to, the global... the global extremist Islamic empire. So there is there has been an attempt, I think, to take the very real horrors that have occurred in Western Sudan and twist this in the direction of a crusade that is dear to the heart of the administration. And that's what we have, I think, on the front page of the New York Times this morning.
I don't know if that's some kind of authentic... gambit or whether, you know, does it really mean NATO troops? Is it a way of getting more commitments from the Europeans, or is it going to be cover for whatever U.S. troops can be mustered. I'm not sure
where
that's going. It seems to me the NATO is exactly the wrong direction to go. And if
we agree.
There are African troops that could be supported by NATO equipment and logistics.
Exactly.
That would be a much more appropriate solution.
And American money. I mean, NATO, you know, look at NATO. NATO is a very strange beast.
Yeah.
I mean, NATO is a way for the United States to run the armies, to run the militaries of Europe. A hangover from the Second World War and from the Cold War, where the Second World War, won in Europe by the Soviet Union, is wrested away from Europe and the Soviet Union by the United States and the generation after 1945, and the U.S. emerges as an imperial power controlling the military of essentially economic rivals in Europe. This is a very odd phenomenon. And it was the NATO, of course, that the Clinton administration set up to reduce Serbia in 1999. I mean, that's the attack on Serbia was engineered through NATO. The Clinton administration made a point of avoiding the United Nations by saying, oh, well, it's okay, we're going through NATO, which is an international organization, therefore we don't have to worry about the United Nations. Now, it's seems to me that, you know, as Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And I hear a rhyme from Serbia and Kosovo in Sudan and Darfur. Mm. I mean, there was indeed ethnic strife going on in the former Yugoslavia when the Clinton administration beat the drums
for the US.
Yeah. And how do we know this won't happen here? Albanians and Serbs in Kosovo were actually, it was more clear-cut than the half-dozen ethnic groups that are after one another in Western Sudan. All of whom, by the way, to an American eye would look black, and all of whom are Muslim. So I'm very suspicious of the American position, and I have to say there are a lot of good-hearted liberal groups in America that are saying something must be done about Darfur. We know that it's genocide because Colin Powell told us it was genocide, and the Republicans and the Democrats in the administration all agree that it's genocide. Well, therefore, it's genocide.
Not enough time to explore.
And we've got to do something about that.
Subtleties of our distinctions. I think something must be done, but as I say, I think it should go through the African troops, and the U.S. should spend the money to rather than try to have NATO, which is, after all, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
Exactly, right.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization maybe should do something about Greenland melting.
That's not a good idea. That's not a bad idea at all.
But then I remember having a conversation with a Moroccan guy. He wanted King of Morocco wanted to join NATO at some point.
Well, thereby hangs a tale.
He said, well, it's North Atlantic, but Turkey's in it already. So, I mean, it's whatever the U.S. wanted to do at the time.
The Moroccan connection came up this week. The U.S. wants to build a prison. I mean, wants to use Morocco as. Look.
Get
if we got to
get
people out of it, yes, exactly. If we got to get people out of Guantanamo, if people are calling for even the closing of Abu Ghraib, I mean, what are we going to do with the people that all Rumsfeld's new special operation folks pull up? New word is send them to Morocco.
It'd be better to have some Arab jailers involved in the thing, I guess.
Well, that's one of the attractions.
And Maghrebi soil.
And if the Moroccans want to, want to play games with NATO, they've got to play games with Rumsfeld, I guess. We should remember that the United Nations' own investigation of Darfur, which was published last January, a year ago last month, found horrible atrocities, but no genocide in the area. And therefore, we want to ask, why is it necessary for all the political groups who may have ulterior motives in this matter suddenly to agree that what's going on in Western Sudan is genocide?
Well, I don't think all have. And the point is that...
Republicans and Democrats in the Congress and the administration, that's a pretty good list. And, other groups that are perfectly happy to ignore 4 million dead in Eastern Congo and perfectly willing to ignore, say, the unwillingness of American drug companies who for a few dollars could save deaths that are occurring at the rate of the Rwanda massacre in southern Africa right now. No, we got to concentrate on, quote, genocide in Darfur.
It's subject to manipulation, but when you ask the UN people why they didn't call it genocide, they said, well, the crimes are bad enough, but you have to have intention for it to be technically called genocide, so let's not quibble about what you call it or what you don't call it.
Not a complete analysis of the report, Paul. I mean, it wasn't just because they thought that there was a good-heartedness and something on the part of the Sudan administration. They don't. I mean, they were willing to talk about crimes.
They're just
saying genocide, you know. Genocide is being used for for essentially political purposes here, just as it was in Serbia. I mean, what was going on in Kosovo was labeled genocide. And the minute you do that, then you pull in all the political baggage from Rwanda to the Second World War. And that seems to be what the... proponents of more NATO activity in Sudan, like the administration and Senator Biden and the rest of them, have in mind.
If you're curious about the Kosovo critique, again, Chomsky did the definitive book link
absolutely.
Study called Military Humanitarianism, Lessons from Kosovo.
Yes,
if
exactly.
I recall. Mm-hmm. So, it's well documented as usual. Only have a few minutes left. I guess I'll leave that hanging. No, I won't. The thing about
don't
New Orleans,
tease it and leave it.
The thing about New Orleans that I wanted to get to earlier was that the astonishing thing about this whole catastrophe was that Lake Pontchartrain did not flood New Orleans. The Mississippi River did not flood New Orleans. The only breaches were the ones from canals. If the Europeans or a Dutch engineer would look at that, and they would just absolutely laugh and cry at the same time. It would have been so inexpensive to buffer the canals from the bodies of water that and I think it was mainly Lake Pontchartrain to keep the flood from rising in those canals, and then absolutely none of this would have happened. I mean, eventually maybe a five would have come in and actually had Pontchartrain go over its own levees, but that's not how it happened. And I rarely hear anybody comment on how ludicrous this whole devastation was in a way. I mean, it's really ludicrous because, you know, this one didn't have to be the big one. It's outrageous.
I'm going to be in New Orleans in a few weeks, and I'll give you a first-hand account of what it looks like.
Smells like.
I must admit that I would this large amount of money that's being made available for cleaning up from Katrina. I mean, more was voted again by the Congress this week, and the housing prices of the destroyed houses within New Orleans continue to go up quite remarkably. It seems to me, Paul, that the best thing to do is not to assume that this is Holland. The best thing to do is to tear down the levees, open up the area, and move New Orleans. I mean, let the back to a more natural coastline.
I disagree. Holland and the Pays Bas, the lowlands of Europe, pending the raising of the sea level, have done an excellent job. 70% of the country is below sea level.
Yeah, but I mean, there's no need to do that in southern Louisiana, except the fact that, New Orleans was always there. One of the things that's happened from the hurricanes and so forth is the destruction of the wetlands south of New Orleans and downriver from New Orleans. You can continue to spend an awful lot of money protecting a city that is below sea level, or you can move it to higher ground. I think buying off the people who are there now and moving the city would be far better.
Well, there's something we disagree on. There's no reason to actually do it. And as I point out, the engineering that would have done to have saved it from this particular storm was pretty trivial.
That's a question of what you want to spend your money on, though. It's maybe trivial, technically trivial. It would be very expensive, and it will be very expensive to put it in a Holland-like situation. Again.
This NPR VOA connection, flashpoints.net, is a good source for that. They have an interview with Ali Abu Nima. We didn't get out the quote that the U.S. and Israel don't want to starve the Palestinians, but they want to put them on a diet.
Yes. Wasn't that an amazing comment? Yeah, right. That was just shocking. That's from Dov Weisglass, the intellectual bodyguard of the comatose prime minister of Israel. Code Pink, the anti-war group, wanted to bring some Iraqi women here to the U.S. for a conference. They were denied visas on the grounds that the Iraqi women didn't have enough family left in Iraq that the American government could be sure that they would go home. Why didn't the Iraqi women have enough family left? Because they had been killed by the United States attack. Now, that's chutzpah in an amazing sense, isn't it?
Chilling irony. What else do we have?
We're out of here.